All right, welcome back to the show. Thank you guys so much for joining us. And we've got a special guest with us today. We've been talking for several years about the role of currencies. And I understand that for a lot of our listeners, especially the non-professional listeners in the audience, that this may seem a bit esoteric. This may seem a bit complex. But when you live in a world based on central bank liquidity and central bank intervention, you know, you go down the list of priorities or you go down the list of factors, and quickly, at least in our estimation, you start pinning everything on currencies, right? We can keep intervening as long as currency valuations are not a concern. And in that light, I wanted to have on this guest today with us, by the name of Luke Grohman, and he's joining us from Cleveland. Luke is the proprietor and founder of a research firm, The Forest for the Trees, based out of Cleveland. And he does, in my estimation, some of the best research and work on the dollar. So, Luke, without further ado, thank you so much for joining us, and we're happy to have you.
Thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
Well, and what the listeners don't know, Luke, is that this is essentially a two-for-one, because we did already interview you a couple days ago, and a little technical glitch of ours erased the entire interview. So thank you so much for being kind enough to run this back.
Oh, no problem at all. These things happen, so happy to do so.
What a guy. All right, well, hey, let's just come right out of the gates firing. First of all, I love your research. I'm a member. You know what? Before we even get going down this path, people can go to your website, FFT. Is it slash? I want to make sure I don't screw it up. What's our web address again?
Sure, it's FFTT, FrankFrankTomTom-LLC.com. And then you go, I think it's a slash, but there's a subscribe area where it's a tab called Tree Rings. You just click on that.
Yeah, and if you want, you know, I am a subscriber, so full disclosure there, and I think that the value that you guys are delivering for $9.99 a month is pretty incredible, and I would recommend, especially, you know, if you're professional, it's an obvious, you know, easy one, considering the price of some of these other research subscriptions out there, but also if you're trying to understand this as a retail investor, it's a phenomenal way to get some insight from firms like yours that are dialing in on this currency and global macroeconomic developments like very few are. I cannot recommend it enough, especially for the price. I think you guys are putting out a heck of a product. So thank you for that. I'm a subscriber and I'm enjoying it very much.
Thank you.
No problem. Okay, so now that we've got that said, give me a little 30,000 square foot view, Luke, on what you guys are seeing right now, and what is what are the things that are keeping you up at night? What are the things that you are watching closely? What are things that you see you think maybe are unraveling now? Kind of give us the Luke Grohman Forest for the Trees take on where we're at right now in the global macroeconomic cycle and you know, currency valuations, and just kind of your guys' 30,000 foot view of where we're at.
Sure. So, if you would have, I think, in fact, when we did talk maybe a year or so ago, at that point in time, the trade war was starting to maybe pick up a bit. By August of last year, you know, our thought was that it was going to get worse before it got worse. and what we meant by that was, if you look at the real, it's a matter of national security for both the United States and for China to not grant what the other side really wants in this trade deal. And, you know, for the U.S., you know, they want, China wants economic sovereignty, the ability to import commodities in their own currency, which we think is a key underpinning to all of this, and they've been making moves in that direction. And the United States does not want to grant that ability, because if it does, it creates an accelerating fiscal and balance of payments problem for the United States, which will, it ultimately means that United States deficits will begin to matter again for the first time in 70 years. And so the deficits we've been running for much of the last 70 years, effectively without tears for the United States, and in particular for the U.S. dollar, that period will end. And so we'll be allowed to run deficits, but the Fed will have to monetize them and the dollar will suffer. And so we thought that because of just the very fundamental nature of each side's sort of red lines, that we thought that hopes for a deal were probably misplaced. Throughout the back half of last year, some of that manifested itself in risk markets in the fourth quarter. And then beginning in the first quarter of this year, when we saw some of the meetings, we saw some of the particularly curious personnel. And what we mean by that is for what was supposed to be a trade deal, we were seeing, you know, Secretary of the Treasury Mnuchin meeting with the governor of the PBOC, Yi. And they were talking about cybersecurity. And with all due respect to both gentlemen, I doubt neither one of them are in the top 10,000 cybersecurity experts in either country. And so our take on that as we moved through the first quarter was, wow, it looks like maybe they're working on some sort of a currency deal, some sort of revaluation or you know, new Plaza Accord, if you will. Markets were acting like that was the case as the price of everything was going up. The dollar, which by all accounts should have been going up and up and up and up, was really not going anywhere. If anything, it was a little soft in the first quarter. And so, you know, we thought markets were suggesting this, and certainly the curious personnel discussions were suggesting this. Mnuchin all but confirmed this in about 4 weeks ago when he came out and said that there is an FX component and that it's just about done. He said that again a couple of weeks ago. And so we thought we were sort of well and on the way perhaps to some sort of currency deal, which, you know, our view is that that deal would be dollar negative, risk asset positive, broadly speaking. And then you sort of had a spanner thrown into the works. I guess it was two weekends ago when the Chinese reportedly came back with a heavily redlined and redacted or redlined agreement of all the things they wanted taken out that they had previously agreed to. And Trump responded by saying, all right, 5 days from now, we're raising tariffs on a whole bunch of stuff by 25%. And in that time, obviously, our view of the odds of a deal have deteriorated markedly. That kind of caught us by surprise. And I think more recently you've seen, you know, what we would term, quote unquote, serious people sounding surprisingly economically nationalistic, whether it's Lloyd Blankfein, the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, tweeting about the merits of tariffs, whether it's Tom Friedman agreeing with Steve Bannon on CNBC last week about a variety of different economic nationalist programs. And so it brings us to today. And, it looks like we're, you know, back to sort of the it's going to get worse before it gets worse view.
It's optimistic. I love the outlining of the Steve Bannon and Tom Friedman and Lloyd Blankfein. It the thing that cracks me up about this cycle is just the world of, I mean, we knew it about politics, but boy, the world of finance really has generated some strange bedfellows. You're seeing these divergent views and divergent world outlooks coming together. And, you know, I can't figure out whether that makes me nervous or probably nervous. That would probably be the most wise take on that. Now, okay, on the tariff issue, one of the things that I think about, and full disclosure, I think you and I probably view this a bit differently. As a matter of fact, I know we do, although I'm still digesting some of the stuff we talked about in the first our first go round attempt at this, just because you threw some stuff at me that I hadn't heard of and I hadn't thought of before that kind of, you know, it certainly rocked me a little bit and challenged some of my views. But starting off, something we didn't talk about last time, do you think, as has become popular on Twitter, do you think China's playing Go? And you know, for those of you that don't know at home, Go is this, I believe it's a game that originated in the East, specifically in China. I don't know the lineage or whatever, the origins of Go, but it's sort of this, like chess on massive steroids would probably be the best way to describe it. Very complex game, can take forever to play. Did they see this? Were they planning for this response? Where do you think they're at in all of this? Are they worried? Are they concerned? If we can spin around and look from the Chinese perspective, what do you think their take is? And you know, I obviously there's a bit of speculating I'm asking you to do here, but from what you see, from the data you're looking at, what do you think? Were they expecting this from the United States? Did this catch them off guard? Are they prepared to deal with it? What are your thoughts on that?
I think there's a couple ways you can look at that. The overriding answer to that is, are they playing go? Is, I think, yes, on some level. I think some of that is cultural. From the standpoint of this, culturally, they tend to look further out in advance than we do.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of that is, you know, political convenience. I mean, look, when you're running an authoritarian government, you can say, here's where we want to be in 5 years, and here's what we're going to do to accomplish that, and it gets done. And, you know, as opposed to ours, which is, you know, has its merits as well, but one of the merits is not, you know, getting things done. It's, you know, here's what we'd like to do, and then 16 different people have 16 different cuts and go to their constituencies, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's some, you know, element where, yeah, I think they are. And now, part of the reason I think that's the case is, if you look back factually, there's evidence to support that. So if we go back to 1999, there was at the time, he was a lieutenant colonel, I believe, in the Chinese People's Liberation Army. He wrote a book, I forget what the name was. His name's Liao Qiang is the gentleman's name. But it was effectively, you know, sort of alternative warfare. I'll have to find the name of the book. But the punchline is this. He was discussing the way to beat the Americans is by cutting off capital flows 20 years ago. Alternative ways of beating the U.S. Now, somehow, despite the fact this book was published in 1999, we still advocated for letting China into the WTO in 2001. More recently, we saw this gentleman again surface in 2015 to 2016, making presentations to the Chinese Central Communist Party to, you know, elaborating on how the U.S. has used the dollar as a weapon historically, and that they are now going to try to use the dollar as a weapon against China. And that if we are going to not suffer the same fate as these other nations, such as Southeast Asia and the USSR and Latin America, then we're going to need to do things differently. And so when you sort of take a step back, and when you sort of, you know, turn the argument, you know, so often you hear, well, gosh, China's centrally controlled, it's centrally it's authoritarian. And, you know, from people that are, you know, either bashing or negative on China, however you want to phrase that. Then the corollary to that is this gentleman was a lieutenant colonel in 1999, and he's a full general now. And he was saying these things. And if you believe that there is centrally planned and controlled, as, you know, I think is probably a fair assessment, this gentleman was promoted in that environment by, even though he was saying these things. And so when you take the step back, I think they have very clearly foreseen, or at least clearly foreseen, the likelihood of, you know, number one, the reality of the United States' mathematical entitlement position, that eventually, you know, we owe people $200 trillion in entitlements, and we've reserved very little of that, to basically zero that, and we're going to print that money, and that we would weaponize the dollar at some point. And sure enough, we've been increasingly weaponizing the dollar, particularly in the last 5 or 6 years. So to answer your question, I think they have been acting more proactively than they are given credit for. I think some of the inconsistency and speed of Trump has thrown them off, and I think you can find things about that, you know, that they've been surprised by that, and just sort of the unpredictability of Trump. But I, you know, there was an article last week talking about how Huawei had already stockpiled 12 months worth of, components.
Yeah.
And, you know, that doesn't necessarily help you for more than 12 months, but I think there are, you know, I think there's been that foresight. Now, to be fair, the U.S. political establishment, you know, is basically flying a supersonic jet by looking at the ground as the plane whizzes by, which is fine until you hit the Rocky Mountains and slam into them. But I do think there are entities within the United States, primarily within, you know, a variety of different Defense Department and Defense Department think tanks that do evaluate the world in a much more, for lack of a better phrase, Asian or Chinese manner. In other words, here's where we are today. here's where we want to be in 5 years, and here's where we think, you know, the sort of range of outcomes could be and how we need to react if they do those things. But culturally, yeah, I think that they have been I think they've been playing much more of a long game than certainly than we have.
Yeah, well, and that's obviously not saying a lot.
No, it's not.
I mean, I think that our government now, and I think our budget to a large extent, and even policy, whether fiscal or domestic or whatever, you know, I think it happens on a 2 to 4 year election cycle. Maybe that's not new, but it's just a constant game of kicking the can, and we're not really out in front of things very much. Now, as it relates to, so let me lay out my case a little bit here and kind of give you my thesis, the way I see things. And then I want you to kind of, you know, correct it, if you will, pick out the errors in what you think, you know, our view is. I see it a bit as a game of of currency chicken, if you will, because, you know, I'm looking at Chinese, I don't know if it's fair to call it dwindling. I don't know how much we can trust Chinese data, period. But it is clear that we've seen roughly a 20-25% reduction in FX reserves with China, at least as it's reported. It's clear that the current account went negative in China for the first time in 20-some years, 23 years, something like that. And I see their economy as having usefulness. In some ways, I see it like Tesla. I don't want to confuse and muddy the waters here. What I'm saying is, you know, I think the truth, as with most things, lies somewhere in the middle. I don't think it's all garbage. At the same time, I do think that there's a massive, and I think it's impossible to say there isn't, this massive buildup of debt in a relatively short period of time in China. You know, this is the biggest debt experiment of all time. It seems to me like both sides have currency issues that are unavoidable, and it's almost like whoever's currency starts suffering first is going to, you know, they're going to be the first to blink, lose the game of chicken, whatever. Do you think that that's an accurate description as the currency game of chicken that's currently going on? And if so, I would, and I may be putting words in your mouth, but do you think the U.S. will blink first? Do you think the U.S. runs into trouble first, or do you think the Chinese will run into problems stabilizing the currency, maintaining the peg, you know, all that stuff that they're dealing with? Who blinks first?
I think it is a much more neck and neck race than most people believe, between who blinks first or who hits the wall first. And I think it is heavily dependent upon China's ability to successfully import an increasing share of their commodities in their own currency. Basically settle, you know, oil and gas, and for ease, I'll just say oil, to settle oil imports in yuan. And if China is successful in doing that, then the U.S. will hit the wall first. And if the U.S. is successful in preventing China from doing that, then China will hit the wall first. And what's interesting is that what hitting the wall first looks like kind of has different paths, right? So if the U.S. hits the wall first, the way that's going to look is the Fed's basically going to buy every Treasury bond that the Treasury issues in ever-grading amounts, and the dollar is going to fall sharply, and U.S. stock markets are probably going to run like a scalded cat. Eventually, that will be reflected in gold prices at some point, but that's a sort of a separate discussion. And it'll be good news, really, for the global economy, because as the dollar falls, the giant dollar short position, you know, effective short position that exists out there by virtue of all that dollar borrowing, will be able to be covered much lower. And we saw a little glimpse of that in 2017 and 18. When you came into 2018, there was, you know, global coordinated growth was the catchphrase then, that we were going to have global coordinated growth. And, of course, that completely fizzled through all of last year. And the reality is that what people thought was global coordinated growth exiting 2017 and going into 2018 was really just the dollar falling 12% in 2017. And so if the U.S. hits the wall first, ironically, it's going to be really good for the U.S., really good for the world, really good for the global economy. It'll be bad news for certain interests in Washington, a very narrow set of interests in Washington. And you turn around and look at if China hits the wall first. Look, China's got $40 trillion in debt. Lehman had an $800 billion balance sheet. Lehman's $800 billion balance sheet was enough to bring the world's financial system days from ATMs not working, the system entirely collapsing. And so, to me, is it possible China hits the wall first? Yes. That said, if China hits the wall, the entire world economy is going to go Chinese. In other words, the Fed is basically going to have to, or the IMF or somebody, you're either going to have Armageddon in markets where literally you shut them down for 2 to 4 weeks and you can only get so many dollars out a day, and I hope you have rations, and the boats stop going until the letters of credit are re-going, and then we kind of get it restarted with global fiat currencies completely all reset, or the Fed just, you know, monetizes everything everywhere. But there's you know, that path, you kind of get to the same path no matter what, or to the same endpoint, relatively quickly, because again, a problem with $800 billion was enough to take the system down. A problem with $40 trillion will do so much faster, much more violently, and worse. So you go back to this, you know, who's closer? To me, it's all about, does China have are they gaining the ability to print yuan for oil effectively, to basically get foreign suppliers of oil to sell to them in yuan? And the game for the U.S. is we need to stop foreign suppliers of yuan oil from selling in yuan. And so if I take a step back, we see that last March, China launched this yuan oil contract. It was widely expected to be a flop. It was not a flop. In fact, by fourth quarter, it was rivaling Brent for front month volumes. You were seeing major trading houses supported on some level. You were seeing a number of or a couple different Middle East countries saying they were using it. It looks like so far it is going better than expected. The flip side is since then we have seen the United States sanction Venezuelan oil. We've seen them sanction Iran again. We've seen tensions with the Russians escalate. And those are sort of your big three of willing to sell oil in yuan. And so, you know, who will hit the wall first? You know, as long as the United States can keep all of Iran's oil, all of Venezuela's oil, and somehow get the Russians not to sell any oil to China in yuan. Now, we're talking about, I don't know, probably 45% of the world's net exports from those three countries. But if the U.S. can somehow do that, then I think China will hit the wall first. The challenge is you're now into geopolitics. You know, the United States tried embargoing Japan's oil in 1941, too, August 1941.
That didn't work.
We all know what happened to December. Yeah, no, we all know what happened to December 41. So. Yeah. We're starting to venture into away from just pure economics and into geopolitics and et cetera. But to me, the key to answer your question as directly as I can, the key of who hits the wall first is China successfully able to import their more and more of their oil bill in yuan? Because if that's the case, they have control over their current account.
Yeah. Okay. So. Yeah, a lot to think about. This is why I love having you on. I've got to remember sometimes that I'm actually doing an interview and I can't just sit here and space out like I'm listening to a Macro Voices episode, you know? Come on, stay with us, Zach. Okay, so now let's flip it over a little bit and take a look at this. There's something that you say all the time that I find really interesting, and I got to confess to you, I'm not 100% sure what you mean. We guys in our industry aren't supposed to say that, right? I don't know what that means. We're supposed to play dumb. We're supposed to play smart, rather, and just, you know, sit there. Oh, yes, nod our heads. But there's something that you say that you've said it many times that always catches my eye, and I've wanted to ask you this question for a long time. You talk about that nobody is more short U.S. dollars than the U.S. government. What do you mean by that?
Sure. So, you know, by way of background, you know, it's a common thought comment, and it's true that there is this dollar shortage existing, this big incipient dollar shortage, which is once you borrow dollars, you got to pay them back with interest.
Right.
And so that is a short position, right? It's another is borrowing. And it's frequently pointed out how big China's short is, how big the aggregate emerging market short is, how big, you know, the world is short, massively short dollars. All true. The problem, or not, you know, the thing that is never mentioned or rarely mentioned, and why we keep making this point, is that nobody's more short dollars than the U.S. government. And the reason is if you take a look at what is owed, if you look at, you know, the United States owes an estimated, you know, $22 or $23 trillion in federal debt. Okay, that's a dollar short. We owe those dollars. Then you got to lop onto that about another anywhere from 100 to 200 trillion in entitlements, which up until 2008, there was maybe some hope or some thought that there would be entitlement reform at some point on some level. How 2008 was handled, which was basically print dollars and give it to everybody, no matter how badly they had screwed up. The real political cost of that means it is now impossible for the United States to engage in entitlement reform in any real way from a political standpoint. You know, after you spent all that money bailing out banks, you can't go to mom and pop and say, hey, you know, we were going to give you $2,000 a month in security, but now we're only going to give you $1,000. The reality is that 100 to 200 trillion is now going to have to be printed as well. Then you further layer into how financialized the U.S. economy is, both on a percentage basis, but more importantly, in an aggregate, you know, sort of gross basis. So there are countries with a higher percentage of banking system assets to GDP. I'm not sure there's any countries out there with a higher percentage of banking assets. And of course, those are all, generally speaking, financially sensitive or interest rate sensitive. And, you know, then you go into, you know, the fact that we're the biggest oil producer now in the world. And so as the dollar rises, all else equal, oil falls. And so we're sensitive there. Of course, our oil is very financially sensitive since it's, you know, shale is a function of technology, high cost of oil and low cost of capital. And so if the cost of capital rises, you know, your the amount of the cost of oil production rises, the marginal break even rises, the industrial activity slows. So you're looking at the U.S. economy from the federal to the financialized side to the industrial side. You look at mortgage debt, you look at corporate debt, you know, which are, you know, back or through all time highs. And it's all one giant short position on the dollar. And so when you total all those numbers up, you know, yes, all these other places are very short dollars, but nobody's short $200 to $300 trillion like we are. And $200, $250 trillion, we'll say, between the public and private sector. You know, $200 plus of that is off balance sheet. But AIG showed us, you know, that just because it's off balance sheet doesn't mean it's not an obligation. And, you know, those obligations, because of U.S. demographics and global demographics, but U.S. are the ones we care about. Are all coming on balance sheet, right? The entitlement programs are going cash flow negative increasingly. And so when I say that, that's what I mean, is that, you know, we're short more dollars than anybody. And the response, of course, is, well, we can print dollars and they can't. And I say, yes, exactly. That's why I'm structurally bearish on the dollar, because if we do not print dollars, we will be one of, if not the only nation in history with a fiat currency to default on our obligations for, you know, in an attempt to preserve the value of the currency.
Well, and I think that, and I think it's really important that we point out when my personal take, and time will tell, certainly, my personal take is that, getting back to the China side of things, that they will blink first. I think they're going to have a currency issue. It's kind of the way I see it playing out. However, we cannot confuse that with being a dollar bull per se. I was listening, speaking of macro voices, I was listening to a interview that Eric Townsend, just a recent one, did with Brent Johnson, and they were talking about, I'm a dollar bull. Well, not really, right? You know, I might think the dollar's going up in the near term, but I am not bullish long term the dollar because of all the reasons that you've said. I mean, I look at it and I think that. As most rational people, I believe, or I assume, would think that the dollar is a one way ticket down. I mean, of course, historically, every fiat currency in history has failed. You know, but you talk about those off balance sheet liabilities and those. I mean, it's staggering. It's absolutely staggering. And we're obviously seeing no real effort made to rein that in at all. And now we're hearing people talk about MMT. And, you know, I mean, it's just, it's they're not, we all know what's going to happen, right? It's not like we're going to get religion overnight. We're going to constrain budgets and fix this thing and get this thing turned upside down. We started this game in 08, 09. You know, you start printing. And they're not going to stop. I mean, they're not going to stop until the keys of the press get pulled away from them. And that's going to be a ridiculously ugly scenario. So, you know, if listeners are hearing me, I am not disagreeing with Luke at all. I'm questioning the order of events at which it happens because I you know, the points you make are really irrefutable. Now, there's something else that you talk about. It was really interesting. This is a little bit off topic, but you brought it up. The financialization of the U.S. economy. You started saying a couple of years ago, and again, it was something that caught my eyes, that you believe that the market is now leading the economy. It reminds me of a conversation I had with my dad as a youngster, where I said, what do you mean the economy's not doing so great? The stock market's up. And he explained to me the difference between the stock market and the economy, and how the economy leads the market. You've been saying that because of the intense financialization, you and I talked about this on the last interview, or this interview, the one that was lost, unfortunately, the chart that shows the makeup of assets of household wealth in the United States. In the 50s, it was something like 90% or 89%, something like that, of household wealth was in real assets, CDs, cash, gold, things like that. And less than 10 or right around 10% were financial assets, so stocks. Things of that nature, securities. Then you fast forward to today, and it's literally the inverse. 90% or slightly better than 90% of household wealth is financial assets. And I thought it was really interesting during this the last quarter of 2018, how the market tanked, it got ugly, and consumer spending dropped. And I think most people said, oh, the market was overreacting to consumer spending. And I sat there and thought, and I actually thought of you because I sat there and I went, you know, I don't think that's what happened. I think you've got so much household wealth, especially accumulated in the last 9 to 10 years, that's been generated and is held in financial assets, that when markets take a dip, consumers pull back. Do you see this as kind of coming to fruition, the things you were talking about several years ago? And what were your thoughts about that in Q4? Did you notice that? Do you think that's what happened?
I absolutely think that's what happened. And, you know, the math is pretty straightforward. And, you know, I think the flows can be discussed and debated that actually drive it. But, you know, U.S. equity market cap is 155 or 160% of GDP. If you look at U.S. consumer spending, you know, personal consumption expenditures, or PCE, is about $14 trillion line item. So it's about 65-70% of GDP. And if you look at just net capital gains plus taxable IRA distributions from IRS data, those two line items are around 200% of annual PCE growth. And so it's not to say that people are selling stocks to buy, you know, stuff that's in the PCE, which is a very broad category. But what it does tell you is the relative sizes, and it bears out. You saw it in 2008, you saw it in 2000, you saw it in the fourth quarter, which is when stocks fall sharply, it quickly nets out any, you know, other consumer spending that's taking place underneath that, particularly because you look at that 200% of PCE number from net capital gains and taxable IRA distributions, that does not include incentive comp. And so let's go back to when I was working at a regional bank that was heavy in the mortgage business in 2003 to 2006. I was there, 2001 to 2006. I was there, and it was nice given my salary level, my base pay. Every quarter I would get a slug of options out of thin air, created completely out of thin air. And it was nice. I let them there, and then I check on them in 2 years, and the mortgage guys down in the headquarters are killing it because it was a one-way street. And so all of a sudden, those options that were granted to me at X are now worth 3X. And maybe not 3X, but it, you know, say it was, you know, they're in the money, right? And so it is very, you know, there's a very leveraged response to that. And so I would sell the options. I would, you know, come home, say, hey, honey, there's a free $4,000. Let's redo the kitchen. You know, and then, you know, hey, honey, here's a free $10,000. Here, let's go redo our bedroom.
Yeah.
Hey, honey, here's a, you know. And so this happened. This was a great deal until 2005. And then all of a sudden the stock started falling. And those option grants started getting less in the money. Then they were out of the money. And then, you know, by 2007, one of my dearest friends is an architect in a very high growth area of the United States. Had this big luxury house set to go for a Wachovia executive. And the Wachovia executive called him in early 2008 and said, I have two numbers for you, 33 and 6. And he said, what are those two numbers? He said, 33 was the price of Wachovia stock when we started this. 6 is the price now. I can't afford the house. We're canceling the project. And so there is this very binomial, you know, when you look at the options side, this all goes back to 1995. President Bill Clinton signed legislation that said that cash compensation above $1 million is non-deductible to a corporation. And so corporate executives began taking a growing share of their comp in incentive comp because it was the legislation exempted that. So anything over $1 million, you couldn't deduct from the corporate income statement for tax purposes. But if you took it in stock, that was okay. And so what was in a measure attempted to equalize wealth or income disparity amongst high-level executives and the average working class actually did a 180-degree opposite and made it infinitely worse. And what it fed into is all these options are taxed as ordinary income. All this restricted stock is taxed as ordinary income. So when you see data from the IRS like last year where 5% of taxpayers paid 60% of the individual income taxes and 30% of overall U.S. tax receipts, those top 5% of taxpayers are not making their money in cash comp. They're all making all that in incentive comp. And so we have to add that number to the 200% before. And what it all points to is the United States economy is basically a giant levered to the stock market, right? It's a giant. It's another way that we're short dollars.
Yeah. So
I was not surprised at all to see the data soften the way they did. You know, the other inference you can make from this is look, if stocks fall, the United States loses the trade war. The best weapon we have is access to the U.S. consumer. Well, stocks fall 20% and stay there. There is no U.S. consumer. And so we need to keep stocks up.
Wow. Yeah, you know, the other thing that I didn't even think about this last time or on Friday when we had this discussion was, you know, we've seen this to some degree with our own clients. I think one of the things that people are looking past is that you've got the largest. Well, I mean, millennials are now too, but we're not at all widely dispersed in the job market yet. But you've got up until the millennials, you've got the largest and the wealthiest generation in the country heading to retirement, right? Going retiring every single day, which means that they will be living or leaning to a much greater degree than any previous generation. They're going to be leaning on those assets as the lifeblood of, you know, to finance the rest of their life. That is only going to exacerbate that, right? The biggest, most wealthiest generation in the country or in the history of the country, all of that wealth is disproportionately concentrated into financial assets. It's only natural, right? If they take a 25% hit to their portfolio, you know, Johnny and Sally aren't going to get the G.I. Joe with the Kung Fu grip for Christmas, right? We're going to back that off. You know what I mean? That's another side of it that I hadn't thought about. And you were talking and it smacked me across the face because I've heard my own clients say that. I've heard my own clients say, you know,
plug in 25% less into my portfolio terminal value. What does that mean for the next month? Well, that means next month you have to cut spending by $1,000.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a great point. And we're going to jump around and I know you can take it, but I've got a lot to ask you. Okay. So there's a nut now flipping back. We focused on the U.S. here. Now going back to China, one of the things that I've heard you again talk repeatedly about is really to me. And so kind of a two-part question, really to me, China comes down to the yuan. Can they maintain the peg? Can they hold the valuation of the yuan where it is. And the reason, again, for listeners, I know you know this, Luke, but for the edification of our listeners, the reason why I think that that's a really big deal is you've got this massive amount of debt buildup in an incredibly short period of time. And largely because of, you know, anytime something goes wrong, especially in the state, you know, the state-owned enterprises over there in China, you know, you have a debt blow up or a default of any size. You got the PBOC stepping in and basically backfilling the balance sheets, you know, issuing new debt, keeping those companies solvent. They can continue to fill those holes as long as the price of their currency remains relatively stable. Now, And so that's the first part of the question. Do you agree with that statement? Then the follow-up of that is going to be, now, there's a correlation that you have drawn, and I've seen the data. It seems to match up, but I don't understand why, and I'm not sure I get the point that you're trying to make. Every single time we see a yuan devaluation or a drop in the valuation of the yuan, we see outflows from the bullion banks in Europe. And you pointed this out over and over and over. What do you attribute to that to? What do you know, it's one of the things, one of the reasons I love reading your research is because a lot of it is stuff that I haven't thought about before, I haven't looked at before, I haven't, you know, conceptualized. And then the other side of it is too, you know, you know it so well, you say it like, you know, like you're making a very casual observation, like, but what does that mean? What do you draw that correlation to? What are we seeing? What are we seeing when that happens? Why is that? Why are those two things coinciding?
Yeah, I think ultimately I think ultimately what it is China has realized that remember we said before, they recognize that the U.S. has used the dollar as a weapon in the past against emerging markets. There's a number of different I think most people would agree with that on some level. The Chinese realize they cannot compete against the U.S. in a dollar war. We can print dollars, they cannot, as many people rightfully point out. However, they also realize that the Achilles heel to the entire dollar system are the highly levered, unallocated bullion markets, particularly in London, to a lesser extent in the United States. Which is to say, if they can't compete against the U.S. in dollars, but what it appears they've done is set up a system where when the yuan falls against the dollar, it triggers physical gold buying and imports of gold into China. And once it's in mainland China, it tends not to leave by law. What this then does, because there's no limit in theory to how far the yuan can fall, but there is a limit to how much gold is in vaults in London. What it elegantly does is means that the governor on how far the yuan can fall is tied to the amount of physical gold inventory in London and New York, which is de minimis and levered as much as 100 to 1 or more. And so every time you see the yuan fall, particularly post-16, and I'd love to say I was the one who noticed this, but Goldman Sachs noticed this in October 2016. Every time the yuan falls, gold gets sucked out of London and out of New York and flows east to China or Hong Kong. And what this then does is when you're talking about unallocated markets levered 100 to 1, you start touching off a Lehman problem, right? So when Lehman was running into trouble and creditors showed up and said, we want more collateral, when Lehman had to give them that collateral, the value of Lehman bonds fell. They did not rise. And that makes sense because Lehman is becoming less creditworthy, not more. But there was more demand for Lehman collateral. The same thing is happening here, where when the yuan falls, Chinese people are buying more gold. Maybe people holding offshore yuan are swapping their yuan for gold. And at any rate, the gold is leaving London. It's leaving New York. It's going east. And collateral is being pulled out of a highly levered system. Now, this in turn drives the price of gold down because the price of gold we see on our screens is not the price of gold. It's the price of gold liabilities because you're looking at a liability that's levered 100 to 1 on unallocated gold. And when you remove one out, you know, when you remove the physical collateral, the value of the liability, which is the price of gold we see on our screens, falls. You know, the easiest way to think about this is if there's 100 paper ounces backed by one physical ounce, and somebody takes the one physical ounce home and puts it and takes it out of that system, the value of the 99 paper claims left that can get you gold is zero. There's no value to it, or it's whatever the cash settlement value is on the way down towards zero. And so intuitively, it makes perfect sense. But what it really does is geopolitically, it removes the ability to just, you know, bomb the yuan down through some of these critical levels, in my view, because ultimately, you know, can the yuan go break 7 and on to 8 or 9? Should it on fundamental basis? It could. It might even should. But the bottom line is that if that happens, London's going to get drained so fast that you're going to create a force majeure situation in global gold markets. And when that happens, you're going to have London and New York saying, yeah, we don't have any physical left. And China's going to say, oh, it's all over here, and here's the new price. And that new price is probably not going to be very dollar friendly. Mm. And that's why I think it is. And, you know, by the way, for 5,000 years, if you want to know who's rising in economic power and who's falling, just follow the flows of gold. You know, when it was leaving UK and going to the US, we were rising, the UK was falling. Now it's leaving US and UK and going to China, and everyone thinks it's sort of this morbid curiosity, and I'm not sure that's the case.
Mm. Well, there you go again. That is irrefutable, and that's something that I hadn't thought about. You're right. Just follow the gold. That's been a tried and true method for, like you said, 5,000 years. Okay, so now, do we have any good data or that we trust or just in your estimation, if we're thinking about how much gold China currently holds? And I don't mean, you know, I'm not speaking so much like, you know, their entire domestic holdings, including, you know, mom and pop and things like that. But do we have numbers on that? I should probably know that, but I know you do. What kind of gold holdings are we looking at here?
You know, officially, they've got, you know, 1,850 or 60 tons is what they have claimed. The real number, you know, there have been some people that have done really good work on that. Koos Jansen's done some good work. Ronan Manley's done some good work on it. And you don't have to try very hard to get to 10,000. You don't have to try very hard to get to 15,000. You know, now that's not necessarily all official per se, but again, you know, people are very quick to say it's centrally controlled and everyone does what the Communist Party says. And if that's the case, then that's all official. It's just not called official yet.
Right. Good point.
So, you know, it's a lot. It's a lot more than they say. You can see the flows moving. The Swiss government publishes the flows. And, you know, for background, 90% plus of global gold refining takes place in Switzerland. And so they report the comings and goings, both from what countries and to which countries and back and forth. So you do have decent data month to month on that. But, you know, that's how I'd answer that.
Okay, and then compare it to what are we? I mean, we're somewhere around 250, 260 billion reported at Fort Knox. What percent?
Yeah, million. Yeah, 250 million ounces. Call it 8,000 tons, 8,100 tons.
Yeah, excuse me, million. Yes. Okay, so we still have, based on that estimation, we've still got significantly more gold than they've got, right?
In theory, yes, and you know the key is that, again, if the price of gold were to rise a lot, if you had a neutral settlement asset rise a lot in price, like gold, it'd be really good for the global economy. The dollar would be valued appropriately relative to other currencies, which is to say much lower based on, you know. But the issue is that, you know, the U.S. right now can, you know, oh, well, actually we can't anymore. But up until 2014, we could print dollars and people sent us stuff for those dollars. Mm. And we would lose the ability to do that. And that's where we think, you know, we think the world is heading in a world to, you know, sort of goods for goods trade as opposed to goods for IOUs trade as has existed since 1971. It's going back to a more goods for goods trade as it existed for pretty much all of human history prior to 1971.
Yeah. Well, what do you think? The one thing, maybe this is, Yeah, this. Yeah, no, it is. It sounds decidedly pessimistic. But my view on observing financial markets for a couple decades now and being a part of them for, you know, the last 14, 15 years, being a player, small one, but, you know, in the game, managing money. One of the things that, or I should say rather, the conclusion that I've come to when looking at the U.S. currency situation, looking at the Chinese scenario, is here in the U.S., you know, I love the outline that you did with, you know, talking about how short the U.S. government is dollars. We're more short dollars than anybody else. It'd be hard to argue that. But as far as it relates to the world, I sit there and kind of look at the world through that decidedly pessimistic lens that if there's a big problem we see out on the horizon, if there's a big issue, if there's a big fly in the ointment, it's only a matter of time till it comes, you know, kind of a Minsky-type outlook on things. I look at the world, and I thought you, I agree with you 100%, if the dollar falls, it's really not a problem for a while. As a matter of fact, I think it's, you know, like you laid out, I mean, it's pretty much going to be good for everybody. The issue that I see is if we have sustained and much higher dollar strength, you know, I don't know what the, you know, I've heard some guys say 115 to 120 DXY. Maybe it's that, maybe it's high. You know, I don't pretend to know where that break point is. But I look at that as sort of the inevitability. And one of the theories that we've tossed around or that we've looked at is that I do believe that the U.S. currency, and I, you know, we're speculating here, but I think easily in our lifetime, I think we will see it replaced as the global reserve currency. But I think we're going to see it replaced because of dollar strength, meaning that, you know, that it will be a world capitulation and that the U.S. will finally go along. Because if you've got, you know, for instance, let's call it 120 to 130 on the DXY, the whole global economy comes to a screeching halt, right? And, you know, I think at that moment that it would make it politically expedient here in the U.S. to acquiesce to the dollar being replaced. You know, it'd be a way to sell it to the populace. And I look at that and I just kind of think it's inevitable that the dollar will get dethroned. And ironically, it will get dethroned through strength. What is your take on that and poke some holes in that theory?
I think it will get dethroned through strength. I think that's exactly right. Where okay. I disagree is that it's already too strong and there's already metrics suggesting that. Mm. So I hear conceptually, sure, 120, 130, 140, 150, whatever the number is that conceptually possible? Yes. You end up with something that looks like Mad Max at some of those levels because you end up with, you know, 40 cent gasoline, except you have shortages everywhere, right?
Right.
Gasoline is 40 cents. How much do you have for sale? None. Call us next week. With 9 guns for every 10 people in this country, that's not a good situation. but in all seriousness, the dollar's already too strong on a number of metrics. So at 103 3 years ago, summer of 16, U.S. federal tax receipts were falling at a 3% annual rate year over year. So tax receipts are in a recession at a time when our structural deficit is rising well in excess of that number. And if you look historically, anytime trailing 3 month tax receipts fall by more than, I want to say the number is either 3 or 4%, the dollar has been weakened very quickly. Over the last 20 years, every time it gets down 3 or 4% year over year on trailing 3 months, dollar gets weakened very quickly. And we kind of started talking about that, and sure enough, it worked out pretty well, you know, late 16. Well, now we fast forward to today, tax receipts are flattish at 97. Mm. The individual tax receipts were down 2% year over year last month.
Would you attribute that again to the financialization of the economy, meaning that
100%.
Okay.
100%. Because if you look at it, corporate profits decline. If the dollar stays where it is, you're going to be looking at 20-30% corporate profit decline later this year, quite possibly. And if you have corporate profits down 20-30%, 10 to 20, I saw a great chart we had by Teddy Valley. Who had that last week as a proprietary index. You're looking at S&P profits dropping markedly just based on sort of where the dollar, where it is. And I suspect some of that might be trade war related. But if you have a corporate, if the dollar rises, multinational corporations have a translational hit. They have the emerging market growth hit. It just, it filters through in multiple ways. You end up with profit declines. Then they start laying people off, cutting CapEx, doing what they got to do. Now, of course, they're as levered as they've ever been when I U.S. corporations. And so there's a lot more leverage than sort of typical on the downside. So I think, you know, number one, you see corporate tax or excuse me, U.S. tax receipts are already close to falling or falling at 97 on the dollar. And, you know, then you look at the other thing that's really grabbed me recently is this effective funds for Fed funds rate relative to interest on excess reserves. And this is a very esoteric method, but basically Fed funds rate should never be above interest on excess reserves. And it hasn't been since some of the new framework since 2008. But Fed funds have been above interest on excess reserves since March 20th. And the Fed made the only way for the Fed to – the message of Fed funds being above interest on excess reserves is that the Fed is losing control of the price of money in the United States. And the only way for the Fed to regain control of that is to supply more dollar liquidity. And so what this tells us is that 96, 97 on the dollar, there's already a dollar shortage that is getting very acute within the United States banking system. And the reason this is because our deficits are rising and foreigners aren't buying our debt anymore on net. And so we're having to buy more and more of our own debt. And so we're crowding out our own dollar short. And so when I mathematically, if I don't look at, you know, what tax receipts are doing, if I don't look at what's happening with Fed funds rate where the Fed is losing control of the price of money, then yeah, I could see the dollar at 110 or 120 or even 130. The reality is that the U.S. banking system and U.S. government are going to break well before probably 105. And you're seeing the symptoms of that now. And I'm not seeing a lot of people talk about that, but I think they're very important to realize. And the punchline to how the Fed is going to have to fix Fed funds rate is they're going to have to cede control over the quantity of money in order to control the price of money. And are we hearing any evidence of the Fed considering this? Well, MMT. You go back 2 weeks ago and Lael Brainard with the Boston Fed said we need to start looking at World War II era policies when the United States got the Fed said we will buy every treasury that the U.S. issues, a 10-year treasury that the U.S. issues at 2.5%, no questions asked. And yield curve control you're basically demonetizing the debt. Clarita wrote about that in February, the vice chairman. And so all of these things, when you string them together, paint a picture that the dollar is too strong now for the U.S. government and for the U.S. banking system's likes. And so that's not to say it can't go to 110 or 120, 130, but that, you know, we're going to have a severe crisis. You're going to have a very interesting crisis that, you know, maybe it's 103, maybe it's 105, which is the U.S. will be going into a recession and 10-year treasury yields will be rising rapidly. Because there won't be enough demand for the supply.
Yeah, why stop now? You got a $5.5 trillion balance sheet. I mean, one of the things that we talk to our clients all about is it's like traveling to the moon, right? Whether you're off 1 degree or 20, you end up in the same place, right? So, you know, people are like, oh, we can't afford it. Well, we can't afford it. That ship sailed in 71. I mean, and you can make the argument it sailed during FDR's, you know, time. What would stop the Fed from doing that? And this leads into another question I had. You know, one of the things that we were thinking about 2.5-3 years ago was because of some of the issues that you've outlined right there, the real possibility, as crazy as it sounds, and we got laughed at, but the possibility that the Fed could run, you know, could raise interest rates and or allow interest rates to rise and engage in QE at the exact same time. Interestingly enough, and I know you're familiar with it, and I think it was Brainard that came out and said it, maybe not. Somebody on the FOMC in the last, I want to say 2 or 3, maybe even 4 months, came out and floated this idea that, hey, just because rates aren't at zero doesn't mean we can't engage in QE. What would prevent them from doing that? I mean, letting rates float, if not raising them themselves and engaging in QE, couldn't they control that discrepancy between the rates that they're paying on reserves and the real cost of money in the economy? I mean, couldn't they control that? Couldn't they just keep buying them up?
That's exactly why I'm bearish on the dollar. They're gonna. They're right. Absolutely gonna. they're setting the table now. It's not going to make the dollar go up because everyone says, well, we're the cleanest dirty shirt. We won't be the cleanest dirty shirt then.
Yeah.
People say, well, Japan's doing it and it hasn't mattered. Well, let's take a look at Japan. Japan has its defense provided for it on some measure by the United States. But more importantly, Japan has a massive net international investment position surplus, or NIIP surplus. So they've got money all over the world they can bring back. You look at the United States, we have a negative net international investment position, negative $10 trillion. And the Chinese are running a current account surplus, and we're running twin deficits. And so people are saying, well, we can do it, and it won't matter to inflation. It won't matter to the dollar because it hasn't mattered to the yen. And I think it's entirely the wrong conclusion to reach for those reasons. We are so different. And it's just a function of how the dollar system has worked. We had to run those deficits to supply the dollars historically. Well, this is sort of the bad side of that is there's the reason I am bearish on the dollars. The Fed's going to do that, whether they're off by 1 degree or 20 degrees. Yeah, they're going to be off by 20 degrees. They may be off by 30 degrees. But it's not going to be good for the dollar, relatively speaking. It's you know, they're going to have to supply dollars to address a domestic dollar shortfall. And this, you know, this gets into, you know, some of the same dynamic of who hits the wall first, the U.S. or China. I think a key to that is the yuan oil contract. But the other thing is you're seeing domestic metrics, you know, Fed funds rate over IOER and U.S. tax receipts are telling you the dollar's already too strong for the U.S. dollar short. And so it's, you know, you come to the conclusion, two big conclusions. Number one, it's way more of a neck and neck race between the U.S. and China than almost anybody thinks. And number two, they're gonna have to, you know, much sooner than expected, begin growing their balance sheet at a surprisingly high level. And most importantly, it's not going to take a crisis. It's very likely not going to take a crisis to do it. You could see our base case for later this year, early 2020, is that the Fed will begin injecting dollar liquidity in substantial amounts, whether that's growing balance sheet, cutting rates aggressively, with unemployment at 60-year lows, and with the stock market at or near all-time highs. And that's going to be a really interesting, you know, awakening where people say, well, we're the cleanest, dirty shirt. And you go, wait a second, why are they engaging in QE without a crisis, that, you know, without employment having a problem and without a recession? And the conclusion everybody's going to reach at the same time is going to be going, oh my God, they're just monetizing the deficit. They're just financing the U.S. government. And that's not going to be a good period of time for the dollar.
Well, and that's something that I know that you and I agree on. I mean, that's the crazy thing, right? I grew up in a world where, you know, we were talking about it out and, you know, it was like in a galaxy far, far away. You know, they're going to monetize debt in the United States. And everybody goes, oh, you're going to monetize. We've been monetizing debt. I mean, yeah, we call it QE, right? The result is the same. I mean, maybe it's not technically monetization, but it is. And my big fear from when this all started was, yeah, how many times have you seen a country start monetizing debt and stop? Right.
No, they never stop.
Right. Because one begets the other and it just begets, you know, it comes too easy. And, you know, you got people like AOC trying to get elected and, hey, we've got no inflation. Let's just pump the. Yeah, it's just. Yeah. It's taking the, you know, I don't see that ever. That's not going to slow down because it's too politically expedient. Right. We got an issue. We want to get elected.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Just print those checks, baby, and just keep signing them.
That's right. Yeah, I think, you know, the monetization, it wasn't monetization until they stopped shrinking the balance sheet, right? You could always say, you know, it's not monetization. It's just an exchange of, you know, cash for debt, right? It's the, you know, it's just, and that's fine. They're technically right. They are. Until the Fed goes, you know what? Balance sheet's not going to get below $3.5 trillion. Well, guess what you did? You just admitted that you monetized $3.5 trillion. And then when they go, well, it's good. We're going to start raising it at, you know, $100 billion a month for the next 3 months, but just 3 months, and then we're going to take it back off. the people are going to figure out what that is pretty quickly. And look, I'm not moralizing on whether it's right or wrong. You know, like you said, this has been in the cake since 33, since 71. You know, people say, oh, we wrote 2 years ago when after Trump got elected, people said, oh, there's going to be big stimulus coming. I said, big stimulus? FDR promised $100 trillion in stimulus. LBJ promised, you know, $80 trillion in stimulus. And it was all sort of on the come. Well, you know, someday was never going to arrive. It arrived. Here it is. And so, yeah, it to me, it's very clear that that's what's going to have to happen. And that's ultimately why we're, you know, why we're structurally negative on the dollar.
Yeah, well, and if you have a lot of faith in them, yeah, it's just this is just an interim practice. We'll run down the balance sheet. You know, it reminds me of similar talks about we're just going to borrow from the Social Security lockbox. We're going to pay it back. Right. We're just going to borrow. I'm still waiting for that repayment. Right.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, it's not well understood that, you know, when people pay their Social Security taxes, that money goes into the kitty and it doesn't sit there in cash. It immediately gets taken out and spent and replaced by a special treasury bond. And so when Social Security has to pay their benefits, they actually have to sell that treasury to raise the cash to send the benefit, because they send dollars, they don't send treasuries. And it's a subtle thing, but it's as this situation, you know, as the demographics develop, it leads to a very nonlinear increase in supply of treasuries because of how it's been accounted for and handled.
Mm. Okay, so one last thing I want to get in. I know you know you're a busy guy and we got to let you go, but one last thing that I really wanted to ask you about, and I'm not the first guy that brought this up, as a matter of fact, and I'm not, I believe he isn't either, a guy you know, Chase Taylor, Pinecone Macro Research, a buddy of mine. Anyway, I heard him talking about this, and like I said, not the first time, but the most recent, most readily in my memory, in my purview. Pivoting back to China, one of the things that we were talking about in regards to your statement about, you know, who hits the wall first. One of the things that I found interesting that Chase brought up was this idea about, you know, what China's got to pick one or the other. They're in a bit of dilemma themselves. They're either going to win the trade war, or they're going to be able to escape the middle income gap, but they can't do both. So kind of a, you know, we've got our trilemma here, as I believe you coined it. And they've got a bit of a dilemma on their own hands. Do you agree with that scenario that China's got a dilemma and that they've got to choose between escaping that middle income gap or winning the trade war? And if so, how do you think that plays out?
I don't know. I mean, I think if I'm China, you know, I have capital controls. I have a currency that's not convertible. I've got a quorum of American factories, and I'm looking at a potential drop in usage of those factories. And so if I'm China, I can print money, tamp down capital controls, right? They can mail a, you know, whatever, 10,000 yuan check to every man, woman, and child in China and tell them that money is good only if it's used to buy a goods made in a Chinese factory. And that would work just fine. In theory, it's negative for the yuan, the international trade value of the yuan, clearly. But the flip side to that is, you know, then we go back to this system they've set up where if the yuan falls too fast against the dollar, it's going to create a run on London and New York gold, which will create a problem for the dollar, ultimately. I think on some level I agree with him, but I think ultimately it's not as clear cut as that for China. I think when push really comes to shove and everybody's got too much debt, I would rather be the guy with too much debt and the factories than the guy with too much debt and a bunch of paper as my assets, like the United States is. Because if you look, you say, okay, let's take a very draconian view. Let's say trade completely stops between the U.S. and China. Boom. Immediately, U.S. store shelves begin having very big bear spots and stay that way for some time, because as much as people want to say they can move some stuff around, on the margin, no question they can, but the infrastructure to replace a China simply does not exist and will not exist for years. The flip side is, so we would be in a hyperinflationary type scenario, right? Yes, I have a strong dollar, but it cannot buy me, you know, anything except for, you know, toilet paper at Walmart. Okay, great. the flip side of it is if you're China, you're in a deflationary, a depressionary, because I have all these factories and I don't have nearly enough demand. And between the two of those, I would probably, you probably have more operating flexibility in the short run if you're China than you do if you're the U.S., you know, within reason. You know, the U.S. can go to Vietnam, they can go to some of these other low-cost countries, but again, 7 of the 10 biggest ports in the world are in China. And that's a function of us buying from them, the Europeans buying from them, et cetera. But again, there's a lot of other there's a lot of other moving parts. What do the Europeans do in that case? What do the Africans do in that case? What do the Russians do in that case? What do the Saudis do? I think it really keeps coming back to the commodity side, the oil side, because if China can import their own commodities and their own currency, then I think China wins, because China's non-commodity goods surplus is $700 billion. They will not have a currency crisis if they can get people to sell them oil in their own currency.
Yeah, I just question. I mean, if you get into a scenario where they're, I mean, we've seen the capital controls. I just we talked about this the last time we talked. I question whether anybody will be willing to accept their currency on trade, or you know. And I know that
that's the key. And I think
go ahead.
Oh no, I was just gonna say that's the key in what they're doing, right? Which is, if they're not going to run a deficit, you know, they're not running deficits with anybody except basically commodity exporters. So you're basically oil exporters and the South Koreans are running deficit, or the Chinese are running deficits against. So those would be the only people who end up with yuan on net.
Gotcha.
And those people can say, hey, you know, we'll sell you Huawei 5G equipment. We'll sell you cheap plastic goods. We'll sell you higher end manufacturing stuff. Oh, by the way, China 2025 is actually China 2022. And, you know, we will sell you these high tech goods and whatever else. And if you still have a surplus left over, then you can take your offshore yuan and use it to buy gold in Dubai or in Shanghai or in Hong Kong and take it home with you where the Americans can't touch it and where we can't touch it, since you probably don't trust either one of us very much at this moment. And that, to me, is the thing that people are missing, which is it's not a gold-backed yuan. The Chinese are just offering gold as the treasury bond settlement for offshore yuan surpluses if they exist after engaging in trade with China. And it's a floating price, and the gold can't come from mainland China. It has to come from somewhere else, which is ultimately, you know, London or New York. And that, you know, ties back to our earlier point of, you know, as the yuan is internationalized, you have more supply of yuan falls, but ultimately they're using gold to suck up those supplies of yuan for trade creditors that want to, or, you know, or Chinese goods.
Well, I think unquestionably this points back to one of your favorite quotes of mine, or one of my favorite. I'm getting confused here. I'm getting turned around. One of the quotes that you've quoted often that I have copied or take, and I credit you, of course. You know, no plagiarism here. but the gold is going to be the credit default swap of this cycle. And every time you start walking through this, it always seems like we end up there. And on that note, why don't you give us, in closing, the 2 or 3, maybe even 4, whatever it is, what the key things that you guys are laser focused on right now? Well, if you were going to give us advice, I mean, I think the first piece of advice, if I can put words in your mouth, would be to get tree rings, right? get that subscription service so we can know. But give us a teaser. What are the 2, 3, or 4 things that you guys are watching right now that you think we are the most important things playing out? Obviously, the Chinese-U.S. trade war. But what are the things that you guys are really laser focused on right now?
Yeah, I really think it comes down to, you know, watching the gauges out there for. Because I think I think the dollar in a number of different ways is the most important trade in the world, if you will. And everybody's short dollars. And so I think, you know, watching how successful China is in getting away from their dollar trap. In other words, is China making more progress towards being able to import commodities in yuan instead of dollars? If they are, that's good for China. Bad for the dollar. I don't even say it's bad for America. It's good for America. It's bad for Washington. It's good for America. But ironically, what China's trying to do is good for 95% of America. The second thing I'm watching is some of the stresses in the internal U.S. banking system. This Fed funds rate relative to interest on excess reserves is very difficult to overstate how important this is. This is a sign the U.S. government is choking out its own banking system with its size of its deficits in the absence of federal buy-in. And it's a problem. This is a sign the Fed is losing control over the price of money in the United States. They are not going to stand idly by and not inject dollar liquidity into that. And so I think that's a very important thing to watch. And I just think the geopolitical tensions, looking at them, was probably the third I would leave you with, which is, understanding as sort of objective eyes as possible what appears to be happening here. Look, the Chinese stopped buying our treasuries. The Chinese have not been acting in many ways in good faith over the past 10 or 15 years. These are all things that 10 or 15 years ago, anybody in flyover country, from a guy on the shop floor up to a CEO, could have told you was a problem. But serious people, quote unquote, said that we, didn't know what we were talking about. Now they are singing from the same hymnal. The challenge is you're, 10 or 15 years later in the game, which makes the path much more, you start out driving for California when you wanted to go to Virginia. It's helpful if you stop when you get to Toledo, Ohio, rather than when you get to Seattle. And the problem is now we're in Seattle going, oh, shoot, we wanted to be. I caught myself there.
Yeah.
We wanted to be in Virginia, and you can get to Virginia, but it's going to be a little longer, and hopefully you have enough gas and, right? So I think that's the other real thing, is looking at, the puts and takes of this trade war. It's not just about who sells who, what to whom. It's about Liebig's law of the minimum, as we're finding out, right? Boom. We're going to cut off supplies, Huawei access to Android. Whoa, they've got a problem globally. Okay, that's a problem for them. Well, what are they going to do? Well, guess what? If they cut off rare earths, I would go out and go buy, if you need a new phone, I would go get it now, because you may start seeing shortages of rare earth materials and high-cap batteries. That's a problem. Your Tesla.
Yeah.
Will Tesla have access to the batteries they need? I don't know. These are things, that no one's talking about. But again, it's not about who sells what to whom. It's about, whose factory shut down with the removal of just one part. And that is how I think you have to look at this.
Yeah, I know you agree, but it is fascinating. It is, in some degree, terrifying, just because it seems to me like we are bumped. And, the old line, just because something's inevitable doesn't mean it's imminent. The timetable on this stuff is nearly impossible to predict. Yet at the same time, it seems very much like we're bumping up against, we're working our way into a place of being between a rock and a hard place. You know what I mean? It seems like we're coming to loggerheads on so many of these issues, where I think that we are quickly, in my opinion, I think we're quickly approaching that level where kicking the can down the road, like we've essentially been doing for the last, 60, 70 years, is no longer going to be viable. And boy, it's fascinating. Now, before we go, I want to reiterate one more time, not to overplug this. I just really think it's a valuable piece of research that we incorporate into our process. And is your Tree Rings subscription. It's very reasonably priced. I think it delivers, the best bang for the buck from what I've seen out there. And if you guys are interested in that and getting more of Luke's insights, you can go to FFTTFrankFrankTomTom-LLC.com, and you can go to the subscribe button for $9.99 a month. I think it's the best $10 you're going to spend. Anything else that we could you can point the folks to, Luke? Obviously, they can follow you at Luke Grohman on Twitter. What are the other ways that they can get in touch with you and your research?
Yeah, there's some other subscription options there that tend to be more institutionally focused on that subscribe within that subscribe button. But yeah, you can also see where we're up to. We publish a lot of that on at Luke Grohman in terms of speaking engagements or media appearances, etc. And always enjoy people checking out where we're. Where we're going to be appearing, on some of the various media outlets.
And yeah, and also on Real Vision. You're a regular on Real Vision. You're a regular on Macro Voices. You can find his stuff everywhere. He's getting quite the proliferation, my friend. I love your work, like I've told you, and I appreciate it. Even if we don't see eye to eye on these things, I think we see eye to eye on most, and I think we can both agree we're in for some seriously interesting times. So,
absolutely.
Hey, well, I can't thank you enough, especially for doing this twice. It's a 2-for-1. Been enjoyable having you on. Again, thank you for your patience. Thank you for being with us. And, you know, best of luck to you. We'll be watching. And I can't encourage everybody else out there to subscribe. Again, go to fftt-llc.com. Tree rings. Hit the subscribe button. Do yourself a favor. Anyway, Luke, so glad to have you on. Thank you. And you can bet that I will be contacting you in the coming months to try to get you to come on here and give us an update on how you see things are going.
Excellent. I look forward to it. And thanks again for having me on. It's great. Great catching up.
All right, pal. Take it easy. And that concludes our interview, you guys. We got to run. But we, as always, will be back next week. But thank you for joining us. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.